The first chapter includes everything. So if you do the first chapter very well, you have a good foundation. So do not worry if you go slowly. And please stop me if you think that I am going fast. I am prepared to do this chapter with you 100 times if necessary. But we must do it very well. We were talking yesterday of the dialectical argument. A dialectical argument is set in the setting of sets of phenomena in which one set of phenomena seems to contradict another set of phenomena, demanding a necessary blending of these two. This method of argument dates back to ancient times. Plato used this argument in a very large way, and in our modern times, Hegel gave a very definitive form. I don't know if you have heard the name of Hegel, but let me tell you about Hegel. Once again, I will refer to this book. He was a German philosopher. His dates are 1770 to 1831. He examined the nature of thought. How do people think? That was his basic question. What is the movement of reason, with R capital, reason? He found a special connection between reason and reality. Reality which is supposed to be there and reason which is supposed to be here, he found a correlation. And therefore he found the key to reality in reason. If you want to know what is there, he felt if you examine here, inside, in your process of reasoning, you will find out what is there. He says it were a key, and he found that just as reason develops inside your thinking process, so does reality move in the outside world. His famous sentence was, reason is real and real is rational. Reason is real and real is rational. Now this sentence can be criticized in many ways, depending upon what we mean by reason. If you go to Hegel himself without imagining what he meant, this word reason can be regarded as super reason. It is not exactly the reason as we understand normally in our normal process of thinking, but reason as creative, not only thinking instrument, but creative instrument. Normally by reason we mean only a thinking instrument, an instrument of discrimination, which distinguishes one from the other. But in Hegel, the word reason, since it is creative by distinctions, by distinguishing. Real, according to him, is concrete. Reason, in its creative process, brings out differentiations and manifests them. This is the process of becoming. Therefore, becoming is a process of abstraction. Real is concrete. The reason distinguishes the contents of the real and brings out these distinctions, and as they come out, they become abstractions. And then there are steps. Each step is remoter than the other. The first step is nearer to the concrete. The next step is farther from the concrete, until we come lower and lower down to all that we see. The more concrete we are, the more near we are to the real. The farther we are from the real, the more abstract we are. So according to him, we move from concrete to abstract, and then we ascend from abstract to the concrete. So the more we think and think really, the more we reach the real. That is why he thought that if you exercise your reason fully, you can grasp the real. You become more and more concrete. You become one with the real. And we are constantly to approach the real so that we become more and more concrete. Now in this process, he discovered what we call the process of dialectic. Process by which the concrete becomes more and more abstract, and the process by which the abstract becomes more and more concrete. This process, according to him, has a design. He felt that every human being endowed with reason moves in a particular fashion. Unfortunately, reason cannot approach the real without going through steps. It would be ideal if you were able straight to become identified with the real and become concrete. But that is not the power of the reason. He does not speak of any other power there can be. That is the limitation of Hegel. He thinks the reason is the only power we have, and it can go on from abstraction to concrete gradually. His goal is to be completely one with the real, but only real can be a concrete. You, me, who are instruments of reason, can approximate as much as possible, but only the real can be what it is. The real is a concrete experience, according to him. The real is a concrete experience, the total experience. Everything is included in it. So his advice to mankind is to rise from your lower limited visions and reach up to the top. You cannot, of course, reach the top, but approximate as far as possible. This is where Hegel's idea of reason stops short of the supermind. The supermind becomes one, concrete itself, with the supreme, with the absolute, with the real. But you can see that this is a process, although which falls short of the highest. He has conceived the process by which you can become less and less abstract, more and more concrete. Now this description of reason, although not the supreme description, is already a preparation for the supreme description of what we call super reason or super mind. Now according to Hegel, reason in the beginning perceives only one set of phenomena. Then when you strain it further, there comes before you another set of phenomena. Then when you go further, you are able to see the two sets together in some kind of combination, some kind of synthesis, and then you begin to perceive another set of phenomena, and then again another set is seen, which is combination of the previous two. And the previous two already combines the previous synthesis that you already had achieved. So there is a progressive synthesis in which you move forward and upward. Now he found that any human being who uses his reason properly will follow this movement, which he called dialectic movement. You start with one perception and continue to perceive it, try to understand it more and more. There will arise from itself another set of phenomena which you will discover are exactly the opposite of the first. And then next one will synthesize the previous two, which he called the thesis and the antithesis, and the two are united, which he calls a synthesis. So in the process of thinking, according to him, if you really follow this process, you will come across these stages of development. Now there are many psychologists who have considered this argument. Is it really true that you move from thesis to antithesis to synthesis, that synthesis becomes a thesis, produces antithesis, and that produces synthesis? Does it really happen? Do we really perceive the world in this fashion? Now many people dispute it. Many people agree. One of the most famous men who agreed with Hegel, who had a tremendous influence on history of the world, was Marx. You have heard the word Marx. Marx agreed with him that our thinking process is certainly of this kind. But whereas according to Hegel, the concrete was spiritual, not only real but spiritual in character, according to Marx, the concrete was matter. There's a big difference between the two. That is why Marx's philosophy is called dialectical materialism. So whereas he accepted Hegel's idea that the movement of thought and also the movement of the real is dialectical, in which one set of phenomena manifests first, and then the next one is the manifestation of that set of phenomena which is exactly the opposite of the first. But whereas according to Hegel, the first to manifest is the real and concrete and spiritual, according to Marx, the first that manifests is the concrete, the real, but material. It's exactly the opposite theory of Hegel's. You know that Karl Marx made such a tremendous impact on history that Marxism is one of the major trends of thought today. And for some time in the 20th century, he ruled a part of humanity with a tremendous power. What is called Russian Revolution was a result of Marxist thought. It is only now that mankind is now drawing away. Marxist dialectical movement was, for the modern times, was centered on the idea of the state. What is the state? State is a collectivity, which we call society. Any group of human beings is a society. But there is a difference between society and the state. No state can exist without society first. That is why I spoke of defining state with a society first. No state can exist without a society. So society is a basic group. But that basic group is not equivalent to state. State is a part of the society which governs the society, which has the power to govern the society. So unless there is society, there can be no question of governing it. So Marxist thought was centered on the idea of the state and perceived that every society tends to govern itself through an instrument, through a body, through an organization of governance, which governs. So governing body of society is state. Now the question is, who becomes the governing body? If there is a society, a number of people are assembled in the society, who and how that body comes to govern? So according to him, in the natural process, those individuals who are powerful, they as it were separate themselves from the society in a certain way. And because of certain power which they have, they come forward and sit upon the higher pedestal of the society. They separate out from the totality, and because of the power which they possess, they come up on the higher point of governance. So the state arises out of the movement of the powerful by dissociating themselves in one way or the other and coming to the point of governance. Now, what is that power by which these people are able to come out? According to Marx, the present people who are today governing, they have risen because of the power of wealth. According to him, a few individuals, by virtue of possession of tools, tools which are able to produce wealth, by possession of tools, they begin to manufacture wealth, and that wealth they accumulate, and by the accumulated wealth, they come to power. This accumulated wealth is called capital. This is the word capital is used very often in our normal parlance. So if you want to define what is capital, it is accumulated wealth. Now because of this accumulation of wealth, there arises in the society two classes. Those who possess tools and those who possess wealth or accumulate wealth, and those who don't have. the tools and accumulation of wealth. So now you see, the wealthy, if they are theses, those who don't have wealth are antitheses. Those who have wealth, they produce antitheses. Those who don't have wealth. So according to Marx, there is a struggle between those who have and those who don't have. This is what is called class struggle, struggle of classes. He said every society tends to build up this struggle. Those who have the wealth, those who don't have it. And then they fight with each other. So there is a thesis and antithesis. Now there must arise a synthesis. So according to him, there is inevitability of arrival of a synthesis. Now how can this synthesis arise? It is this movement which is particularly seen as a dialectical movement, and there is some kind of inevitability because of the law of thought. Because the thought always moves, according to him, as in Hegel, in this dialectical process. And as in thought, so in reality. So what is in thought happens actually in the world. So according to Marx, we shall move in society at a point where those who do not have are called by Marx proletariat. That's a word, proletariat. The proletariat are those who don't have. So a time will come when the proletariat who are opposed to the rich are called bourgeoisie. Bourgeoisie. You have got bourgeois gentilhomme, no? So those people who belong to bourgeoisie are all gentilhomme, bourgeois gentilhomme. They may be illiterate, they may not even know that they know prose, and yet they have got a lot of riches and they command the society. So there is a battle between bourgeoisie and proletariat. And as a result of it, the proletariat reverses the situation. The proletariat at a given stage of class struggle comes up on the top and the bourgeoisie comes down. It's a movement of antithesis from the other side. It's not yet a synthesis, it's only from thesis to antithesis. Now this antithesis becomes its own antithesis. Its position is reversed. And when the proletariat becomes the master, the governors, then according to Marx, a favorable situation arises for synthesis. What is the synthesis? There will be no masters in the society. It's a synthesis. All become equal. No class struggle. Therefore, his famous aim is withering of the state. The state withers away. There will be no state at all. Now, this is his basic idea. And when in 1917, or even before 1905, when Russian Revolution broke out, and Lenin emerged as a great leader of this revolution, this was the ideal. It was proletariat revolting against the capitalists, against the bourgeoisie, throwing down the bourgeoisie, including the Tsar, who was at that time ruling Russia. They're all thrown out, and the proletariat became the masters. Lenin represented the proletariat and became the ruler. It was the rule in the name of the proletariat. And the idea was that soon a time will come when equality will be achieved everywhere. Class struggle will cease. Synthesis, there will be synthesis. There will be no class struggle. All will be equal and state will wither away. Now this was the vision put forward when Russian Revolution broke out. It is that vision which inspired many, many people all over the world. That was a real appeal to common people when they would like to see that they are not trampled under the feet of the capitalists. And they are waiting that bright day when state will wither away. But in 1990, it was found that this was not happening. And this will not happen. You have heard the name of Gorbachev, who was at that time the president of Soviet Union, and as it were called back, it became clear that state, instead of withering away, became even stronger. The heavy hand of the state became so strong that the freedom of individuals was strangulated thoroughly. And when individual freedom is strangulated, the motive to work becomes extremely feeble. And if you don't have motive to work, who will produce? And when there is no production enough, then people begin to rise in revolt. And that is what happened in Soviet Union. The entire state, which had become very powerful, began to be dismantled. Even the Soviet Union, the whole union broke down. So the idea of thesis, antithesis, entering into a synthesis did not work out. Of course, there are many thinkers who believe that the present stage is only a stage. The dream is not to be given up. A time will come again when the state will wither away. But what are the conditions under which the state can wither away, really? That is a very big question mark in the history of mankind today. This is one of the reasons why the theory of dialectical movement has been questioned. Dialectical movement, as described by Hegel, by Marx, in such neat terms, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, does not seem to work out thoroughly well. And yet, it is to be admitted that there is something like a dialectical movement. It may not be as neat as described by Hegel and Marx, but there is something in the world, in the movement of the world, such a movement that would answer to this dialectical movement. What is the truth? What is that truth which answers to this idea of dialectical? Even though the dialectical idea may not have been fully manifested, even if you find that it does not all the time follow that rhythm, there is something in the world which answers to it. In our ashram school, this is in parenthesis, in ashram school, we started an experiment in which we said all education must take place in a condition of silence. Be absolutely silent, because it is silent mind which can receive the knowledge, which is true. So, in one of our experiments, we decided there will be no lectures, because lectures are opposite to silence. So there will be no lectures at all. Everybody should be absolutely silent. They can read, they can contemplate, meditate, but no lectures. Or if the teacher wants to communicate something, he will write down and give that written note to the student, and student will read quietly. If the student has a question to ask, they were advised, speak whisperingly. No noise. You just whisper. All this was very fine. It's a good experiment. I'm only telling you how the human mind works. After a few years of experiment, not a few years, let us say 1 year or 2 years, there was a feeling that this is not working very well. And then some other experiments were made. And after 3-4 years, those who were advocating complete silence, I heard them myself advocating, il faut parler, il faut parler, il faut parler. Just the opposite, antithesis. It was now advocated that without talking, and talk, and talk, and talk, students have to be stimulated, they have to be made enthusiastic. And how do? You talk to students again and again and again. There will be a new outburst of curiosity and knowledge will spread. This was antithesis. And those who were advocating furiously the first gospel of silence now began equally furiously now the gospel of parle, speaking, you must talk. And then came the synthesis afterwards. I think what is called free progress system is actually a combination of silence and talking. That is why I am allowed to talk to you. Otherwise, I would be out. So the idea is that you talk, but talk in such a way that silence is not disturbed or is encouraged, which is a very difficult synthesis. And there should be rhythms of silence and talking, rhythms of personal reflection and acting. It's a synthesis. It's only an example to show how dialectically our system of education has evolved from one extreme to the other and then to a synthesis. But this is because the world as a whole follows this rhythm. From superconscience, the very first step produces inconscience. Now, because of that movement, when inconscience begins to develop, it manifests also sets of phenomena little by little. This is what we call evolution. Evolution is nothing but a gradual unfolding of the inconscience. Little by little, out of sleep, when you awake, eyes are not fully opened. Little by little they open up, and gradually we begin to stir, and then slightly we become awake, and then more awake, and then fully awake. This is what is called the process of evolution. It is because of this process of evolution that there is an answer to the theory of dialectical movement. And that is why in philosophy it has become one of the major movements of thought. And in argumentation, this movement is followed, not always, but very often. It's one of the good ways of awakening the human mind so that the human mind moves from one set of facts and goes to the other and gradually opens up and then synthesizes and arrives at a conclusion which is really real. This is the movement of the second paragraph of the Life Divine. You will see in the very first sentence of the second paragraph, Sri Aurobindo says, these persistent ideals, that is, ideals of God, light, freedom, immortality, are at once contradicted and affirmed. This is the dialectical movement. At once contradicted and affirmed. Contradicted by ordinary experience. Because in the ordinary experience you only get matter. You don't see God, light, freedom, immortality at all. You only see matter. When you open your eyes from sleep, you cannot even bear the light. You want to close down your eyes immediately. Similarly, your first movement is to be confined to the ordinary experience. And in that ordinary experience, if somebody speaks to you of God, light, freedom, immortality, you'll simply shake it off. Oh, nothing, nothing of the kind. I see nothing here. Where is God, light, freedom, immortality? All dark. All is matter. When you move forward, further, then you begin to have, as Sri Aurobindo says, it is affirmed, these ideals are affirmed by deeper and higher experiences. So first there is a negation and then there is an affirmation. Now this affirmation takes a lot of time. It's a gradual movement, and Sri Aurobindo uses the word in its organized entirety. This word is very important, organized entirety. Even if you want to affirm these ideals of God, light, freedom, immortality, since it is a long way from inconscience to that, even if you have glimpses in the beginning, they don't come, these experiences don't come in their fullness, in their organized manner. So you can come to this organized totality of higher experiences only by two methods, either by revolutionary individual effort or evolutionary, that is gradual movement, of general progression of mankind. This is what we had done last time. I only repeat it just to reaffirm what we had done last time. Now we go to the next step in the argument. This opposition between ordinary experience and totality of experience, now Sri Aurobindo formulates in their stark opposition to each other, as it were thesis and antithesis. Now this formulation is one of the most powerful and most potent formulation in philosophy. The stark opposition between the two poles of experience. On one side you experience one thing, on the other side, another pole you go, you experience something else. And Sri Aurobindo speaks of the synthesis of these two poles. So now we shall go very slowly, little by little, we shall see each one of the opposites that Sri Aurobindo describes here. To know, possess and be divine being in an animal and egoistic consciousness. This is the two polarities. We are at present in an animal and egoistic consciousness. That is our ordinary experience. The other pole of experience is to know, possess and be the divine being. That is the formula of God. Then next, to convert our twillet or obscure physical mentality into the plenary supramental illumination. On our side, at present, we have got obscure physical consciousness. At the most, twillet. Twillet is some light either in the evening or in the early morning, darkness either is about to come or darkness is about to go, that consciousness, our consciousness at present, is a twilight consciousness, you might say, at the most. Mostly it is obscure physical consciousness in which we live mostly, because if you count how many hours we spend in our active work, it is 8 hours. 16 hours of the day are either in sleep or preparation to get awake and to start work. So mostly we live in twilight consciousness. So to convert our trilips, our obscure physical mentality, that is true of our ordinary experience. Now you come to the higher experience into plenary supramental illumination. Plenary means that which does not diminish at all, everlasting. There is no alteration between sleep and awaking. So when we say light is a part of the formula, God, light, freedom, immortality, when we speak of light, we don't speak of the aspiration to have some light. It's not an aspiration to have a temporary light. Our aspiration is to have no diminution of light at all. So, this is the aspiration, to convert our twilight or obscure physical mentality into the plenary supramental illumination. Third, to build peace in a self-existent bliss where there is only a stress of transitory satisfactions besieged by physical pain and emotional suffering. This is the third term of our aspiration. God, light, bliss, freedom, immortality. These are the 5 terms of our formula. This is the third term. To achieve what kind of bliss? To build peace and a self-existent bliss. A bliss which does not depend upon any external object. Self-existent. Bliss which flows automatically from our being, it does not depend upon any external stimulation, neither sensory, nor intellectual, nor anything that comes from outside. Self-existent, we should bubble with delight from ourselves. So that kind of delight. So to build peace and a self-existent bliss, this is our goal, where there is only a stress of transitory satisfactions. It's a beautiful expression. What is our present state? Our present state is a state of satisfaction. But this satisfaction has always a stress in it. It's never a stressless satisfaction. Even when we say, oh, I'm contented now, there is some stress in it. So Sri Aurobindo uses the word stress. Stress of transitory satisfactions. They are fleeting. Our satisfactions are only for some time. Even the richest man, when he sits at the back on his armchair after doing day's work and he feels absolutely satisfied, he might get suddenly a news that his son has fallen ill and all his satisfaction wipes out. It's only a transitory satisfaction that we normally have. And even this transitory satisfaction, Sri Aurobindo now qualifies by beautiful expression, besieged by physical pain and emotional suffering. Even when you may be contented, you may not be able to eat sweet because you have got diabetes. When everything is available to you, unfortunately, the physical pain is knocking at your door. So even that satisfaction you cannot enjoy. There is a physical pain and emotional suffering. You will find that all the time in human life, even in the best conditions of your bliss, suddenly you will find somebody becomes angry with you. Somebody is dissatisfied, somebody revolts, somebody sulks, and you do not feel satisfied at all, and you begin to move out of yourself to satisfy something or the other. Imagine the life of Dashrath. When he announced that Rama will be crowned the next morning, what a tremendous happiness spread over the whole town. But in a small corner of the big palace, the queen herself, one of the queens began to stir in an opposite manner and made a demand, the stark demand, that Rama should be exiled. And when the father, who was so much happy, his happiness had no bounds, he completely sank into torpor. So our satisfactions are besieged by physical pain and emotional suffering. to establish an infinite freedom in a world which presents itself as a group of mechanical necessities. Our life is a life of necessities. We are obliged to eat. It's a necessity, no? Minimum necessity is that we are obliged to sleep. We cannot be free from sleep. Even if you want to keep awake ever and ever and ever, you cannot. We are necessitated to sleep. We are necessitated to eat. We are necessitated to have physical movements. Necessitated to breathe. Our whole life is nothing but, if you don't agree with the theory of necessities, you can say it is 9/10 of our life is a necessity. Maybe 1/10 we have some freedom of movement a little. I can decide whether I shall move this way my arm or I shall move this way my arm. This kind of freedom I certainly have. But otherwise our life is full of necessities. And yet human being aspires for freedom. And what kind of freedom? Sri Aurobindo says, to establish an infinite freedom, complete freedom of Shiva's dance. He could decide whether he will dance in one way or the other or other or other, or infinite ways of dancing. Or he will dance all the dances at the same time, even that he has a freedom. Not only dance only one way at one time. At the same time he can dance in million ways, that freedom. And it is that freedom which is available on the other pole of our existence. To establish an infinite freedom in a world which presents itself as a group of mechanical necessities. Now the last term. That is, now we have God, light, bliss, freedom. Now the last term is immortality. To discover and realize the immortal life in a body subjected to death and constant mutation. Our life is subjected to death, or at least to change all the time. There to find immortal life, that in a body, this is the sharp contrast between the state of immortality and the state of mortality. The one set of facts set against another set of facts, exactly opposite of each other. Thesis and antithesis. It is to bring about that light in these conditions, to live that divine life in a life which is animal, to establish that light in a state of darkness or half-awakeness or twilight consciousness, to establish that bliss where there is only a partial satisfaction besieged by physical pain and emotional suffering. It is this, as Sri Aurobindo says, this is offered to us as the manifestation of God in matter and the goal of nature in a terrestrial evolution. Evolution, that is the important word. All this opposite has come about because of inconscience. Because of the inconscience, there is a gradual movement, and that gradual movement is what we call evolution. And if you want to see that this evolution moving forward, what is the goal, then this is what Sri Aurobindo says. This is offered to us as the manifestation of God in matter and the goal of nature in a terrestrial evolution. This is the definition of the divine life, which is the title of the whole book. What is the divine life? The divine life, formula of the divine life is to know, possess and be the divine being. To convert into a plenary supramental illumination. To build peace and a self-existent bliss. To establish an infinite freedom and to realize the immortal life. These are the words which define the divine life, the life divine. The entire question of the book, the whole book, has three steps of its basic argument. I use the word argument because it's a philosophical book. It has three steps of the argument. It says first, it asserts that there is a human aspiration. This human aspiration wants divine life. All human beings, whether they like it or not, whether they want it or not, whether they are conscious of it or not, every human being is seeking divine life. This is Sri Aurobindo's affirmation. First argument. If you don't agree with it, then there is argument here. The whole book is an argument. If somebody says, no, human beings do not seek divine life at all, it's not true, then this book is meant to answer that question. Is it really true that human beings are seeking the divine life? Sri Aurobindo's answer is, that is the real human aspiration. And he has defined in clear terms. Very often, people who do not read this book quite nicely, they say, Oh, Sri Aurobindo does not define terms. It's one of the criticisms made by many people. Because many people, when they write philosophical books, first of all they start words and then they define them. Then the people say that now this is called an accurate, philosophical, polished, exalted philosophical book. My answer is, please be patient. Sri Aurobindo defined every possible term in the life divine. Whenever you find this term is not defined, it's only your impatience. At the right time, every word is defined. And full definition. And perfect definition. This I can tell you because I have been reading this book for the last 50 years. So I can say it is verified by me. And this I am telling you also, the divine life, the life divine is the title of the book. And Sri Aurobindo defines this term in the very second paragraph of the book. You don't have to wait more. Because in the very first paragraph, Sri Aurobindo only puts a proposition that human beings have aspired for divine life. So by the time you finish a sentence, immediately Sri Aurobindo defines this term. So there is no delay at all. As soon as he finishes the first proposition, that human beings are full of aspiration for the divine life, the moment you finish a sentence, Sri Aurobindo defines this divine life. So this is the first step of the argument. What is the divine life? Define the divine life. And the statement that all human beings are in search of the divine life is the first argument, first step of the argument, which can be questioned. And Sri Aurobindo allows this questioning, and a major part of the book is allowing this questioning and answering it. We shall see how he questions himself and how he answers it. The second argument, the second step of the life divine is to tell human beings that this aspiration is fully justified. That is to say, if you look at the whole world, if you look at all aspects of facts, take into account the totality, to pursue totality is a basic function of philosophy. You remember in the very beginning we have defined philosophy. Anandmayi will tell us in her definition, this word totality is a part of that. Is it there or not? Totality. If it is not, you have to change the definition. In your definition, you read again in your definition, philosophy must deal with totality of facts of all domains. Right? What is the word you have used there in your definition? Read aloud. Philosophy.
Quest for knowledge pertains to all domains, including the quest for perfection, both individual and collective. It results in the formulation of an idea or ideas pertaining to the totality which includes all that we see and experience.
That's right. First of all domains and then totality. So Sri Aurobindo shows the totality of facts, that if you consider all the totality of facts, then even rationally, even you're using your reason, because reason is not something entirely to be thrown out. Reason has some great glories. And one of the glories of reason is, it always demands from you totality. It's a great glory of reason. It may not be able to grasp all at once, but its tendency, its thirst, is towards totality. Therefore, even rationally, you entirely go step by step. If you don't see all the facts simultaneously, don't worry. Sri Aurobindo will show you domain after domain. The whole book is nothing but showing you the world domain after domain. That's why this book is a book of knowledge. All the domains, if you want totality of knowledge, open the life divine. If you want the knowledge in all its domains, Sri Aurobindo has given all the domains in the one sweep, as it were, in one book, all the domains are included. It's a very great speciality of this book. I have never seen a book in the world which deals with totality, with all the domains of existence, and gives you verifiable knowledge. Verifiable knowledge, not only belief, verifiable knowledge. Therefore, the reason can be completely satisfied. So, this is the second argument, second point of the argument. If you consider all the facts, then you will find, if you examine all the domains, you will find that this aspiration is justified. Sri Aurobindo says, do not fear to aspire for divine life. This is the assurance of the whole book. And finally, the third step of the argument is, that if this is what we should aspire for, how shall we achieve it? How shall we realize it? How shall we fulfill it? The process by which you can fulfill it. The last portion of the life divine is entirely given to this task. How shall we fulfill? By what means this divine life can be realized. And this book, combined with Synthesis of Yoga, gives a complete answer to the third question. How shall we realize the divine life on the earth?